today we're going to be talking about truthfulness in prayer. The sort of backdrop to that question, in some sense, is that prayer at times can be a difficult and challenging task for a variety of reasons. Some of those might be environmental. We might be in a space that's not as conducive to prayer. We might be in a community that feels uncomfortable in one way or another. But another core feature of prayer, which stays with us in every encounter with liturgical prayer, is the text of prayer itself. And oftentimes, we encounter in that text, as we read it or as we recite it, theological claims that can be hard to sustain or hold on to or accept sort of with full faith and confidence in the way that we might want to. They pose difficulties in all kinds of ways. They might pose moral and ethical difficulties. They might strain credulity from where we stand in the 21st century. And I wanted to explore with you today some of what our tradition has to offer in thinking about how important and in what ways it is important that we speak truthfully when we pray. Sort of on its face, it would seem like truthfulness is something valuable. But in those situations where we come up against the difficulties of praying truthfully, it's worth considering what our sources have to say about the importance of truthfulness. And together, we're going to look at four different models of what truthfulness in prayer can look like and what its place might be. So we're going to start today with the first model of truthfulness in prayer, which I have entitled here, The Brutal Truth Between Prayer and Drash. So we begin here with the Mishnah in Masechet Berachot, first tractate of the Mishnah, where we are told, Ha'omer al kan sipur yagi'u rachamecha, just skipping for the moment, Mishatkinoto. One who says, may your compassion reach the bird's nest, we silence them. So someone who makes this claim in the course of leading prayer, if they say, may your compassion reach the bird's nest, among a number of other things that are listed here, which you can see, the congregation is responsible for silencing them. We don't really permit them to make this kind of claim as a part of the activity of public prayer. And together we're going to look at a commentary of the Hon Ashir, an early 16th century Kabbalistic commentator on the Mishnah, who engages with this statement and tries to plumb the depths of why it is that it's so problematic for someone to state, to say, to recite in prayer, may your compassion reach the bird's nest. He begins by first clarifying, in his view, what he thinks this statement even is in the first place. Ha'omer bitfilato al-kan sipur richamta yagiu rachamecha af aleinu mishatkinoto. So according to the Hon Ashir, the actual theological claim that's being made is not, may your compassion reach the bird's nest, but you had compassion on the bird's nest, al-kan sipur richamta, may your compassion reach us also. So the claim is that we are trying to draw out and illustrate for God, God's compassionate side by pointing to the way God had compassion on the bird's nest. And we ask that God have compassion on us also. The context for this compassion on the bird's nest is the law of Shiluach HaKan, the sending away of the mother bird. There's a responsibility that if one wants to take the chicks or the eggs from a nest that one happens upon on the way, one is responsible for sending away the mother bird before taking the eggs or the chicks. And so we say that that is somehow an expression of divine compassion. That's what the claim of this prayer leader is. That expresses divine compassion, and we want that compassion for ourselves also, and that's what we're praying for. But that's illicit in some way. We're supposed to silence them. And why is that? Shaharei bihitpalilo laHashem sheyirachem alav kemo sherichem al kan sipur hu to'eh v'shoel shelo kahogen. Because in praying to God that God have compassion on us as God had compassion on the bird's nest, The person is making an error and asking inappropriately. De mitzvah zo af ki nir'e mi midrash rabba, parashat ki tetze, de midat rachamim hi, de garsinan hatam, de cheshem shenatan hakadosh baruch hu rachamim ala behema, kein nitmale rachamim ala ufot, minayin shenemar ki ikare kan sipur, ad kan, mikol makom midat achzariyuti. So even though it seems like this commandment is an expression of divine compassion, that seems to be the thrust of this passage from Midrash Rabbah, where we read that just as God graced the animals of the world with God's compassion, so too God had compassion upon the birds, which we know from the fact that God commands us to send away the mother bird. That seems like clear evidence that this is an illustration of divine compassion. Mikol makom midat achzariyuti. In fact, it's actually an illustration of cruelty. Dehachi ita betikunei zohar, tikun shishi. This is what we find taught in this Kabbalistic text, the tikunei zohar. Ta chaze, malacha it demimna al ofin, de inu nishmatin, de it kara'a tzipurin, sandalfon shemei. There is an angel that's appointed over those fluttering ones, al ofin, de inu nishmatin, de it kara'a tzipurin, which are the souls that are called birds. And this angel that is appointed over them, Sandalfon Shemei, his name is Sandalfon. Uvizmana di Yisrael mekayimin haipikuda, be'azlat eima mitatarcha ubanin savchin, ihu oliv zachu al ofin, ve'yema lekud shabrichu, ve'aketiv rachamav al kol ma'asav, amai gezirat al ofa di itarchat mikana. And when Israel fulfill this commandment, and the mother is sent away, banished from its nest, and the children, the nestlings, are crying out, this angel appointed over the birds comes and advocates on behalf of the merit of the birds and says to God, didn't you write that your compassion is on all of your creatures? Why have you decreed upon the bird that it be banished from its nest? So that's the Tikkuni Zohar's conception of this commandment to send away the mother bird, that rather than being a manifestation and expression of divine compassion, it is a realization of divine cruelty. And so it's illicit for someone to pray in this way, to pray in a way that speaks to in imagined divine compassion, al kan sipur richamta, you've had compassion on the mother bird, because that's simply not true for the Honashir, right? It's simply wrong to think in this kind of Pollyannish way that this commandment is an expression of divine compassion. In fact, if we look at the brutal truth of this law, we see that in fact, it's a realization of divine cruelty. And so it's not appropriate for us to pray in a wishful way, as it were, to highlight what we think is divine compassion, when in fact that's not true. We have to look the brutal facts of the world in the face, and our prayers need to reflect our assessment of those brutal facts. Interestingly and importantly, the Honashir makes a qualification. And he writes as follows. Aval kishe omer derech drash, shemitzvat shiluach hakan hi midat rachamim, ein mishatkin oto. But if one were to say by way of drash, in a kind of homiletical register, that the commandment of shooing away the mother bird from the nest is an expression of divine compassion, ein mishatkin oto. We don't silence them. It's in prayer that we silence them, but not in homiletical exposition. Shaharei al yedei mitzvah zo, HaKadosh Baruch Hu mirachem al Yisrael. Because as it so happens, this commandment is also a vehicle for God to have compassion upon Israel. Dehachi ita b'tikun anal, which is said further in this same passage from Tikkunei Zohar, uvizmana di Yisrael mekayamin haipikuda, kol mimna oliv zachu al ofin dilei, v'kud shabrichu ma'avid, Kenish lekol chalin dilei v'yema v'chimimna de'ofin dilatata oliv zachu al ofin dilei demimna alayhu v'leit b'choman de'oliv zachu al b'nei de'inun Yisrael v'chulei. When Israel fulfills this commandment, all of the appointed angels advocate for the merits of its particular birds, its particular fluttering ones. And what does God do in this moment? He gathers all of his legions and says, all of these angels are advocating on behalf of their fluttering ones. Who's going to advocate on behalf of mine? Who's going to advocate on behalf of my children, the people of Israel? In that very moment, God cries out and says, you know what? I will act for my sake. And so this occasion for an expression of cruelty becomes also an occasion for God to exercise compassion upon Israel. Uvimidrash root Zohar Chadash ita nami inyanze vegarsina nami hatam man garim lemircham al alma vechule hahu gavra deshalach hahu tzipora letzara. Also in the Midrash root and Zohar Chadash, we find it similarly stated, who is it that causes compassion to kind of come upon the world? It's the one who sends away the bird, paining it. Litzara. Harei mivuar deshiluach haken tzara hu latzipur. Behold, you can see what's being expressed here is that, in fact, sending away the mother bird is painful. Tzara hu latzipur. Umikol makom goreim rachamanut la'olam. Nevertheless, it results in a kind of secondary way, this outpouring of compassion from God onto the world. The full scope of the Zoharic theology that is animating this text is not really of primary concern to us. While it is interesting to think about the theological dynamics of this particular commandment, the main point of interest here is that the Hon HaShir is articulating for us a vision of what prayer is and what prayer is not. Prayer is a space for articulating the truths that we hold when we look with brutal honesty at the world. There may be pieces of the picture of the world that give us a brighter, more colorful, more palatable picture of life, one that's more filled with compassion. But prayer is not the time to highlight those ancillary aspects of the world. We have to look with a kind of integrity and brutal honesty at the world and call it like it is. That's not to say that our theological language and our modes of theological engagement and expression are limited to that register. In fact, it's very important to the Hon HaShir that we have other media for that. It's important that there be drash, that there be homily, that there be exegesis that allows us to live into those other aspects of life, but prayer is not the space for that. Prayer is a space for brutal honesty. That's our first model. The second model that we have is what I've called here making it true. And we begin in this text with a story, as it were. This is in Talmud Bavli Yoma, a story that echoes much of what we just saw in the Hon HaShir. That's perhaps a little anachronistic to say, but nevertheless, this Talmudic passage is echoing what our 16th century Kabbalistic friend has just taught us. Amar Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, lama nikra sheman anshei Knesset HaGdola? The question that is bothering Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi here is, why is it that the men of the Great Assembly are called the members of the Great Assembly? What made them so great? Why did they merit that honorific? And so he begins by telling us, Shehecheziru atara liyoshna, because they returned the crown to its former glory. How so? Ata Moshe amar ha'el hagadol hagibor v'hanura. Moshe came along and he said about God in his prayer, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God. Ata Yirmiya ve'amar nochrim mekarkerin beheichalo ayei nora utav lo amar nora. Yirmiyahu came along centuries later and said, Gentiles are carousing in his sanctuary. Yirmiyahu lives at the time of the destruction of the temple. Where is his awesomeness? Asks Yirmiyahu. I don't understand. It's hard for me to sustain that idea that God is awesome. Lo amar nora. So he didn't say it. He no longer said awesome in his prayers. Ata Daniel amar nochrim mishtabdim bevanav aye givurotav lo amar gibur. Daniel came and said, Gentiles are enslaving his children. Where is his might? Lo amar gibur. So he did not say that God is mighty. And to skip ahead in this text, we see a strong articulation of what is behind this theological move. V'rabanan hechi avdei hachei ve'akrei takanta detakein Moshe. How could it be that Yirmiyahu and Daniel came and uprooted the language that Moshe had established for prayer? Amar Rabbi Elazar mitoch sheyodin ba'akadosh baruch hu she'amitihu leficha'ch lo kizvubo. Because they know and understand these great figures, Daniel and Yirmiyah, that God is a God of truth, that God values truth, and so they did not and perhaps could not speak falsely to him. That in many ways reflects that kind of brutal truth picture that we saw in the Hunashir. These figures are confronting a world in its devastation, and they can't sustain a continued engagement with the language of God's might and God's awesomeness. And so they can't bring themselves to say it. They silence themselves, as it were. But that's not the end of the story. Remember, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi's primary interest here is to think about the members of the Great Assembly. That was where we began. Somehow we're supposed to understand what it is that made them great, that they returned the crown to its former glory. So how did they do that? Atu inhu ve'amru, the members of the Great Assembly came along and they said, Adirabba, zohi givurat givurato, shekoveshet yitzro. No, it's just the opposite. You don't understand. This is precisely God's might. And ruin that you see is precisely an illustration of God's might. Shekoveshet yitzro, shenotein erach apayim l'reshaim. Because God sort of suppresses God's urge, God's will, and sort of extends his patience towards the wicked. That's an expression of divine might. There's no greater expression of divine might than divine forbearance. Ve'eluhei nora'otav, and here too is God's great awesomeness. Were it not for the awesomeness of the Holy One, blessed be He, how could one people survive among the nations? That is to say, how could the Jewish people have survived even in this devastation? This apparently was the great move of the members of the Great Assembly. What made them so great? Their returning of the crown to its former glory. The move here, which is what I want to dilate on, is a move that takes seriously the language of prayer that they inherited, this language of might and of awesomeness and of greatness, takes seriously the devastation and the reality with which they're confronted, and moves from a commitment to both of those things toward a reinterpretation of the language of prayer and a reinterpretation of the world around them. The language of prayer now becomes something other than it once was. God's might is not as simple, perhaps, as Moshe envisioned it. God's might has to be reimagined in some new way. The world, on the other hand, is no longer quite as devastating, as bereft of divine presence as it once seemed. Now it's filled in some way with the manifestation of God's might and God's awesomeness. This is a second mode of thinking about the role of truthfulness in prayer. Sometimes the role of truthfulness in prayer requires us to withhold from speaking certain things. We have to hold back from certain kinds of theological idioms and expressions that maybe we can sustain in other kinds of registers, but that are not befitting of prayer. But sometimes prayer is an opportunity for us to return to traditional language, language we've inherited, language with richness and depth that anchors us, and find new ways of expressing it, find new ways of interpreting it and interpreting the world in its light. We can come to the language of prayer anew every time we pray and see new things in it. Mechayei Amitim, that God revives the dead, might mean one thing to us in one day and another thing to us on another day when the world can no longer sustain one interpretation of that phrase. And when we reinterpret that phrase in new ways and think about the juxtaposition perhaps to Somech Noflim, that God lifts the falling, we might gain a new appreciation for the world and for the way God's presence manifests in it. That is our second model of truthfulness in prayer. On that basis, extrapolating from Yirmiyahu and Daniel, we could surely not utter any praise of God in this so seemingly horrific world. It seems to me that the implicit and required point of departure for any prayer to God is to understand and accept that the ways of God of Israel are unknown to us and unknowable. Yeah, that may be. It does seem that Yirmiyahu and Daniel are still able to utter parts of the prayer. But what happens when the prayer as a whole becomes unsustainable? What do we do in that moment? I think the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah maybe were feeling in that way in some respects and came to their solution to it. But I think you're proposing another possibility, which we're not going to explore so much in this session, but another possibility of navigating truthfulness and integrity in prayer is a posture of humility in the face of things that seem unknowable. It's an important theological point to make, and I'm glad you brought it to our attention, even as we won't devote our time to it in depth. The third conception, the third model I want to offer here is what I've called here not yet fully true. We've spoken about prayer as maybe a site for expressing the brutal truth and prayer as a place for kind of manifesting new truths, as a site for interpretation. But it can also be a place for engaging with what feels not yet fully true. And to explore that idea, I want us to look together at a passage from the Pachad Yitzchak, written by Rav Yitzchak Huttner, an important 20th century American, mostly based in America, theologian. He's working here with a passage from Bavli Psachim, Nun Amud Aleph. So there in Bavli Psachim, we have the following claim. V'haya Hashem lemelech al kol ha'aretz, v'yom ahu yiyah Hashem echad u'shmo echad, a phrase that might be familiar from our own experiences of prayer. God will be king over all the earth. On that day, God will be one and God's name will be one. Dilating on the future tense of that verse, the Gemara asks, Atu ha'idana la v'echad hu? What, is that to say that God is not one now? On that day, God will be one? But God is not one now. Amar Rabbi Acha Bar Chanina, lo ka olam hazeh ha'olam haba. In fact, at some level, says Rabbi Acha Bar Chanina, that is true. God is not yet totally one. This world is not like the world to come. Ha'olam hazeh al besorot tovot omer baruch ato v'hameitiv, v'al besorot ra'ot omer baruch dayan ha'emet. In this world, when we receive good news, we say, blessed is the good who does good. And when we receive bad news, we say, blessed is the truthful judge. We divide up the world into good and bad news, as it were, and we can't bless God with a unified blessing in both of those moments. Le'olam haba kulo hatov v'hamitiv. But in the world to come, it will all be who is good and does good. So that's the background for the Pachad Yitzchak's exploration here. Because the Pachad Yitzchak is going to concern himself with something we say in our prayers on Mincha on Shabbat. Namely, Ata Echad V'Shimcha Echad. We say, you are one and your name is one. That seems not to be true, according to this Gemara in Psachim. And so what are we doing exactly making that claim in our prayers? The full statement there is Ata echad v'shimcha echad u'mika amecha Yisrael. You are one and your name is one, and who is like the nation, your nation Israel? That last phrase will become important to spelling out the Pachad Yitzchak's point. So writes the Pachad Yitzchak, Bekesher im shevach ha'achdut, yeshnam diburim asher ha'kol ram nimna mehem, mapa'at bilti heyotam behet'em le'erach ha'matzav shebohim nishma'im. In relation to the glory of God's unity, there are things that cannot yet be stated with a full voice. Ha'kol ram nimna mehem. Because they're not really suited to the environment in which they're heard. Aval adayin nis'arhu halev al etzem ha'achdut shekavu ha'chachamim batfilah. Indeed, the heart convulses over the theme of unity fixed by the sages in our prayers. Ata echad v'shimcha echad u'matbea tfilat mincha de Shabbat. That's the formula of our prayers on Shabbat. We say God is one, and His name is one. V'halo yadanu d'nevi'im shelifnei anshei kneset hagdola lo amru ha'gibor v'anura, ki mitoch shegadu'u bo ba'kadosh baruch hu she'amitihu lo kizvu bo. We know that the prophets that preceded the men of the great assembly didn't say the mighty and the awesome, because they knew that God values truthfulness and they didn't wish to lie. As long as they felt in their hearts, as long as they took it to be the case that God was not providentially guiding the world in the manner of awesomeness and might, right, nations are carousing in the temple, it would have been impossible for them to make these kinds of statements. So our heart should drop. How could it be that we fix in our prayers a statement about God's unity? Halo mifurash shaninu ki hanhagat ha'ashkacha lefi ha'torah shel ata echad hi hanhagat Hayom hahu, ve'anagat hayom hazeh, eina lefi b'chinat Torah achdut. We know from the passage that we just saw in Psachim that the God's providence in this world is not actually a providential guidance of unity, of God being one and God's name being one. That's for that day, for the day to come. Ve'alo gam ha'nevi'im shelifnei anshei kneset ha'gdola yadu'u ki atidim me'em ha'torahim shel gibor ve'anura li'itgalot be'acharit ha'yamim. Now, of course, the prophets knew that one day these terms about God, that God is awesome, that God is mighty, would be true again when thinking about the time to come, the future, the end of days. U'mikol makom mikevan shelifi ha'matzav haya be'da'atam shel ha'nevi'im ki aye gevurotav ve'aye norotav. But because in their moment, in their time, it was not possible to sustain a true belief in those things, they couldn't say it, even if they knew that one day again they might be able to say it. It wouldn't have been enough. It's not enough for us to know that one day, on that day, God will be unified. That's not sufficient to warrant us saying here and now that God is one and God's name is one. So how do we square this? How do we resolve this? Omnam la'amito shel davar benogea l'tor ha'achdut lo haya gam b'tchila makom l'she'ela me'in aye gevurotav. Ki achduta shel kneset Yisrael be'etzem hanhagat hayom hazeh So actually, the question that we have about where God's might is not in place when talking about divine unity, because the unity of the people of Israel, which is evident here and now, is the source for the full coming to light of God's unity on that day. So if with God's might and God's awesomeness, we needed the interpretive creativity of the men of the great assembly, with God's unity, the present and evident and palpable unity of the people of Israel becomes the paradigm for the fullness of divine unity in the future order of things. That becomes our anchor for making and staking a claim to God's unity here and now, the present and palpable unity of Israel. B'chan hinenu magi'im l'shoresh shinui ha'lashon b'matvei ha'tvilat ha'mincha d'Shabbat. Here we get to the heart of this phrase in the Mincha of Shabbat. Shemidat achdutot yitbarach ve'achdut shemo ba'a hi b'nosach shel hanacha pshuta, ve'od sheshevach achdutam shel Yisrael ba'u b'nosach kruz shel she'ela. Because the statement about God's unity comes as a kind of plain statement of fact, as a simple statement, whereas the statement about Israel's unity, mi ka'amecha Yisrael, who is like the people of Israel, your people Israel, comes as a rhetorical question. Mikevan sheheter amirat ata echad v'shimcha echad na'utzu be'achduta shel Knesset Yisrael hanir'it le'einenu be'etzem ayom hazeh, lachein ba'u shevach ha'achdut shel Knesset Yisrael benosach kruz shel she'ela, hamore alinyan hoveh v'nocheach ve'lo alinyan atid v'nistar. It's almost as though we are saying in our prayer, God is one and God's name is one. For look, who is like your nation, Israel? We turn to this manifest and palpable reality of the unity of the people of Israel here and now to ground and anchor our sense of the possibility of divine unity in a time to come. Rak ma'pa'at heyot shevach achdutam shel Yisrael inyan hoveh v'nocheach, only because the praise of the unity of Israel is something present and palpable here and now, yitachein likboa batvila shevach achdut shmo shel makom. Would it be possible to think, to fix in prayer, the praise of the unity of God's name? Shegiluyo hu be'etzem inyan shel atid v'nistyar, whose full revelation is something that is futural and hidden and concealed. The point, I think, in Rav Huttner's claim here, whatever we make of the veracity of the palpable and evident unity of the people of Israel here and now in our times, as contentious a claim that might be, is that I think Rav Huttner gets us to a new model for thinking about truthfulness in prayer. Sometimes there are certain things that seem impossible at present, that seem like they belong to a time to come, like a horizontal, futural hope that we hold. But the thing that enables us to say those things, to say those hopes with a full voice, is that we can anchor them in real experiences that are palpable and present and live now, that give an echo and a shade and a shadow of what that futural reality might look like. We talk about resurrection. We anchor that in experiences of people rising from sickness, of helping those in need. Those are experiences that ground and anchor our deep sense that something like the triumph of life over death is possible. And it's those experiences that are palpable and real and live now that enable us to make those claims that maybe are not quite ready to be realized in their full truth yet, but are on the horizon of possibility. So I want to turn now to the last model. We've had three models, one about the brutal truth, prayer as a site for speaking the brutal truth about the world, another about prayer as a site for making our ancestral and rich and deep language true, and thereby illuminating the world in its truth in new ways, and a model about leaning into the not yet fully true by anchoring it in those experiences that are with us here and now. The last model I want to offer is what I've called here to make believe. And this model is a model where we don't try to brook the gap between what's true and what we say. So Marzutra visits the home of Rav Ashi, who recently suffered a loss. And on this visit, he opens with a blessing. He offers this blessing. Hatov v'hametiv el emet dayan emet shofet betzedek lokeach b'mishpat v'shalit be'olamo la'asot bo kirtzono כי כל דרכיו משפט, שהכל שלו, ואנחנו עמו ועבדיו, ובכל אנחנו חייבים להודות לו ולברכו, גודר פרצות בישראל, הוא יגדור את הפרצה הזאת בישראל לחיים. A long, beautiful, eloquent prayer. The key point for our purposes is this line in the prayer, who is good and does good, God of truth, the true judge, who judges with righteousness, takes away with justice. Lokeach b'mishpat. That God takes lives away justly. So the Behag, the Baal Halachot Gedolot, an early Geonic work, attempting to codify this blessing into law, says the following, V'lokeach b'mishpat lo neima. We do not say in this blessing who takes away with justice. That part of the liturgy has to be scrapped. De'itotav Rabbi Ami, de'amar ein mita belochet. Because Rabbi Ami's teaching that there is no death without sin, articulated in one place in the Talmud, was definitively contravened. It was itutav. There was a proof text that was brought against it, strong enough to definitively contravene the notion that there is no death without sin. Meaning, sometimes death happens and it's not just. God doesn't always take justly. And so we can't, in good conscience, say that in this prayer. So the Behag, in good Hon Ashir-like and Daniel and Yirmiyah-like fashion, scrapped Slokeach b'mishpat. Shouldn't be a part of the blessing. The Tosafot say the following. Upiresh Behag de'ein lomar b'mishpat, dekaimalan b'perak b'meh b'hema yotza de'yesh mita b'lo chet v'yesh yisurin b'lo avon. So he recapitulates the view of the Baal Halachot Gedolot. The author of the Halachot Gedolot explained that one should not say who takes away with justice, since we hold that there is death without sin and suffering without iniquity. And here's the kicker, umiu bekach ein lemochko. But that's actually not a good enough reason to erase it. We should hold on to it. Now, note, the Tosfot here are not saying Rabbi Ami's teaching was not definitively contravened. Rabbi Ami's teaching still holds. And so there is good, we have good theological grounds for saying it. He's simply saying, yes, it's true. We did upend that theological assumption, but we should say it anyway. We should say Lokeach b'mishpat anyway. I want to propose to you, in the empty space of that Tosfot, which kind of resounds and echoes and is quite fascinating and tantalizing, I want to propose that part of the Tosfot's vision here of this prayer is that prayer is a space that we might call a transitional space, a space where we can open up possibilities for what we wish the world would be like at its best, and hold in abeyance questions about truth and falsehood. Hold in abeyance the theological commitments that we hold outside of the prayer space. This is, as I've just called it, a transitional space, a term drawn from the work of Donald Winnicott, the famous psychoanalyst. Jonathan Lear here in his book called Imagining the End, Mourning and Ethical Life, has a lovely summary of some of Donald Winnicott's thinking about this. And he writes that Donald Winnicott spoke of the need for an intermediate area of experiencing that is not challenged. A space that is not challenged because no claim is made on its behalf except that it shall exist as a resting place for the individual engaged in the perpetual human task of keeping inner and outer reality separate yet interrelated. One of Winnicott's paradigm examples for this, as he calls it, transitional space, is the space of childhood play. In Lear's example with a teddy bear. In the case of childhood play, say with a teddy bear, Winnicott says that it is a matter of tacit agreement between good enough parents and the supporting adult world that we will never ask the question, did you conceive of this, or was it presented to you from without? The important point is that no decision on this point is expected. The question is not to be formulated. We don't press the child playing with the teddy bear, whether the teddy bear is real or something they just made up. That's part of the tacit agreement of playing in that space. And Winnicott's claim is that that's an essential and important space that will always be important in the perpetual human task of keeping our lives in this equilibrium in some way. And so transitional space is not something that's reserved exclusively for childhood play. It's also part of adult life in all kinds of ways. Lear's example here in this essay is about mourning. We friends and supporters of the mourners do not inquire into the status of ongoing conversation with the dead one, with the dead loved one, for example. The question is not to be raised. That's an important area of transitional space. Yes, maybe in our more sober moments, outside of the context of that exercise and activity where we speak with our dead loved ones, we hold certain claims about the world and what's possible, and maybe the silliness of that activity. But in the course of that activity of speaking with our dead loved ones, we want it not to be challenged. We need that resting space to engage in that transitional activity, that space where no decision on the point of the truth of the matter is expected. This space is provided in arts, in religion, in childhood play, and in mourning. And I suggest to you, in particular, perhaps for the Tosafot, in prayer. Prayer, too, can be a space for engaging in this transitional activity, navigating the world at times by holding what's true and what's false in abeyance. One beautiful articulation of this thought, of this way of engaging with prayer, I think can be found in this poem by Avraham Chalfi, the Israeli poet, called Adam Tole et Etmolo, a person hangs his yesterday. Adam Tole et Etmolo al vav takua, biliba shel ruach. A person hangs his yesterday on a peg set in the heart of the wind. Hal'a, hal'a, onward, onward. Sha'ashu'e ke'ilu, ilu, lu, the lights of as if only. Ri'i, hakol kar'u naflu, el margilot shel ein raglaim lo, sheza'amo v'ramo male olam. Look, they all bowed, fell at the feet of no legs has he, whose rage and roar fill the world. V'gamani nofel v'kam, nofel v'kam, nofel u'ma'amin be'emuna shelema. And I too fall and rise, fall and rise, fall and believe with a full faith. It seems to me Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi is being apologetic for God's restraint, and maybe God's true power would be to enable the evil people to turn towards goodness. I think you're right. I think Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, in the guise of this story about the members of the Great Assembly, is struggling with this theological predicament of how to maintain and stay with a liturgical tradition and in its richness and in its language, and hold that with some kind of theological integrity. You know, the most charitable reading is to see them as taking that with, you know, with truth, with integrity. But it may be more tenuous on some days than others for the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah to hold that picture of God's might and God's awesomeness. I see Robert says, whoops, grounding this in the unity of the Jewish people today is a shaky or absurd basis. But in any case, we don't say God is one and his name is one today, meaning for the world, not for Jew, but that will come to pass. So I think that's right when we say it in Aleinu, but when we say it in Mincha and Shabbat, we just say Ata Echad v'Shimcha Echad. We just say God is one and your name is one. And that's part of what's troubling the Pachad Yitzchak, that we've somehow moved away from Vahaya Bayom Ahu Yiyeh Hashem Echad Ushmo Echad, and how do we sustain that as theologically honest in some way?